Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
A month into the search for Nancy Guthrie, there's still no arrest, no named suspect, and no person of interest. But that hasn't stopped names from circulating. One man, a 37-year-old living with his elderly mother, handcuffed, detained, questioned for several hours after SWAT served search warrants on their home. He was released. An elementary school teacher who plays in a band with Nancy's son-in-law, been harassed online and at his home by amateur sleuths convinced he matches the masked suspect. He doesn't. Even the Guthrie family had to be publicly cleared by Sheriff Nanos because the attacks wouldn't stop. So what happens now? Once your name is out there, whether it came from reckless media, police questioning, or internet speculation, how do you get it back? Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help break down the legal avenues available to people who've been publicly dragged into a case they had nothing to do with. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of walking back I'm seeing online by reckless creators who at the beginning of this damn thing were naming names. We didn't do that. And it's almost amazing to watch of, oh, see, they're not part of it. Yeah, no shit. No shit, they're not. One man in the case was detained, handcuffed, questioned for hours, and released. His attorney issued a statement saying he has no link whatsoever to Nancy Guthrie. But as this works now with social media and people finding a name, however they may have gotten to it, whether it be through a creator or whether it be directly through the police department and arrest warrants and documented filings, Sheriff Nanos publicly has cleared the Guthrie family because online attacks wouldn't stop. But a sheriff's statement is in a court ruling. What does being cleared, Eric, actually mean legally here? And if someone wanted something that carries more official weight, does that even exist when you were never charged?
Gosh, I mean, being cleared in it essentially means that law enforcement believes they have ruled out that this person could have possibly done this. They have excluded them as a potential suspect in the case. And so that's a pretty definitive statement. And in fact, law enforcement doesn't usually make such a public statement in ongoing investigations, which is why I was a little curious. That's something. And then I think, you know, in our modern social media era, you know, if this happened in the 70s, one of these people could try to get a news interview and just saying, hey, I feel real upset that my life has been turned upside down. That's one way to approach it.
Sure.
They could do like a kind of a social media announcement just saying, hey, my name has been drugged through the mud, but I've been cleared. I support the Guthrie family. I want the real person to be identified. You know, taking that route can be helpful, but a lot of damage has already been done.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I was curious following up on that. You know, I hadn't thought about that, Eric, but you're right. I mean, think about, you know, historically, all these cases we had in the past where someone was named like this and they have then come on the news media and made these public statements. I can't remember the last time that's really happened. What do you think's going on where people that have, you know, like the son-in-law and this guy that was arrested in his mom's home, you know, what do you think is happening that's preventing them from wanting to do that? Is it because people are going to double down and make it worse, or are they just trying to put their head in the sand, or is there anything legal going on there, you think?
I think there's a few things. I think they probably feel traumatized, for one. I think they might just want this to go away. They want their normal life back. And so if they engage with, you know, thousands or potentially millions of people regarding it, it perpetuates it. On top of that, you know, on social media, there are all sorts of conspiracies swirling around, and some are legit and some are complete nonsense. You know, if you continue to engage, do you potentially expose yourself to more of that negative attention, whether it's warranted or not? And then also legally, you know, if they aren't planning any kind of legal action, it makes sense to keep it close to the vest. But law enforcement usually has qualified immunity against defamation and stuff like that. So that is probably not a viable legal avenue for them.
Well, and it's an interesting landscape we're in, because it's not just, you know, like the 70s, the 80s and 90s, or even like 3 years ago, where, you know, it would be like one entity, like, oh my God. I mean, thinking back to Richard Jewell, if we're going to go old school, yeah, kicking back to the Olympic Park bomber of Atlanta, yep, in 1996. Yep. Big deal. His name was named, and he was dragged through the mud, ended up dying many years. There's a movie made about him a couple years ago. And really, it destroyed his life. Even though he was completely cleared, he had nothing to do. He actually was helping that situation of trying to find out who did that. But the name, once it's out there, it's out there. And people, they get stuck on something, and then they won't let it go. And this is, it's not just an outlet, it's not just X news station, XYZ news doing it. It's a cacophony of hundreds, maybe thousands of people that all get their mind set in one direction, and then they dig, and then they keep going with their theories, and then they keep presenting. It's a spidering. It's like bed bugs. Like good luck getting rid of this problem. It's an infestation of the idea, and it just keeps going. And you can't, it's like you can't whack-a-mole it, because there's too many moles to whack. You can't go after the one entity and say, stop reporting this or we're going to sue you, or just suing them. You can't like legitimately sue. I guess you could, but you'd be going after hundreds, if not thousands of people with an opinion online, and good luck trying to do that as a solo individual that doesn't have a gazillion dollars to spend on prosecution. I mean, this is, it's a new landscape where, A, people do seemingly have the ability to say almost anything they want online with very little repercussion. Yes, people have been sued. We saw it in the Koberger case, the person who was accusing a professor of having something to do with it, $10 million verdict in that one. And that's great. I'm happy that that took place. But I mean, how do you tackle this? That was one person. When you have thousands of people out there online all saying horrible things about your name, and you had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Oh, gosh. You know, for example, like you said, Tony, you know, if you're this high profile person, if you're the president or something, and mm-hmm. there's a news outlet that falsely reports information about you, you could sue them. You know, could just a lay person have likely the same success? Probably not. And then on top of that, when you're talking about, you know, thousands of people online, what are you going to send 1,000 cease and desist letters? And then if they don't stop, what are you going to sue 1,000 people who probably have no assets? There are serious collectability issues with any kind of such lawsuit. So your options are totally limited. You could go on the offensive and you can make your own statements. But gosh, in terms of legal remedies, those are pretty scant in this context.
Yeah, I'm curious, Eric, you know, we're bringing up some amazing, you know, sad facts right now, where there's so many people you'd go after that it's really changed that landscape. Do you see the defamation laws kind of changing and evolving to meet that demand now, or you think it's going to stay the way it's been?
Well, what I see, Robin, is a trend towards social media platforms being held more responsible for what happens on their platforms. And there are certainly differing ideas about whether that's appropriate, but there is a trend in that direction. Meta is being sued for, you know, allegedly addicting children to their products, things like that. And so whereas those social media platforms used to enjoy almost blanket immunity on stuff like this, I think things are changing. And so I think that perhaps there might be some responsibility on behalf of these platforms to ensure that there is correct information that's being posted. But then again, that's a tremendous quagmire in and of itself. There are free speech issues. It is just a huge, huge mess with no foreseeable clean solution.
But go ahead, Tony.
I was going to say, I mean, it's an interesting thing because if it's really not that extremely different than a TV station having reporters and then the TV station putting out a story. I mean, granted that there is a chain of command where the TV, the news director says, yes, this gets on the air or doesn't. But in some cases, that's very lax. Sometimes it's okay. Here's the package you put together. Let's get it on the air. And it goes to air without a ton of oversight. And TV stations in the past have been sued for reporters somewhat going rogue or not checking their sources or reporting information that's inaccurate. How, I mean, is this all that different at the end of the day when we're talking about something like Facebook or X or whatever, as you're the TV station and guess what? The people on your platform are the reporters, quote unquote. I know they're citizens, they're just individual people, but look, if you're going to create the platform and give them the mic and give them the opportunity to reach just as many people, if not more, than a television station or a radio station or a newspaper would have in more traditional media days 10, 20 years ago, it's just a new variation of it. You're the outlet, you're the station, you're letting this go over your airwaves or your platform, which would be Facebook or whatnot. It's not governed, obviously, by the FCC, but the FCC also doesn't necessarily have laws about defamation. They have laws about content, about words you can and can't say. The defamation comes in basically more so towards liability of the TV station. You don't want to do it because you don't want to get sued. It should be the same, I would think, in social media land as well. You're making the platform. You're platforming people to say really outrageous and audacious things. That's no different than a TV station saying, you know what, we're not going to give a shit what our reporters do. We're not going to double check them. We're just going to let them say anything and everything they want. And how dare you come back and say that it's our problem for broadcasting this out there? No, it is your problem. You're broadcasting it. A TV station would be shut down if this was going on today. But it seems to be different because it's a website.
Yeah, I feel you. I mean, let's be clear, Meta and these big social media platforms, they're making billions. They're just making stupid, stupid money, in part due to the engagement of their users. And that engagement can be inflammatory. It can be defamatory. It can be completely fabricated. And at least so far, the platforms haven't been held responsible for that. So they're making all the money, but they have none of the risk. They have none of, when people pop off on social media, might say something completely false and defame another person. That's money for them. Should it also be a potential liability? Should there be some quality control? Should there be some oversight just in terms of how those web platforms function and when harm is caused, who is responsible? Because you're not getting any money from, Johnny, the Facebook user, but no. You might get money from Meta if there was such a legal pathway.
I know some of the challenges with defamation is demonstrating damages. And I apologize, Eric, have you worked defamation suits before? Yeah, because I'm curious, what are the challenges for defamation? Because I know it's a very, very hard thing to prove. And so what are some of the challenges that people face? So for example, in the Guthrie case here, what were some of the challenges be for one of these people that have been accused to actually file a defamation suit and actually prove it in court?
Few things, Robin. So one of the challenges is whom you can actually sue. So you typically cannot sue law enforcement. They have qualified immunity. If they make a misstep in investigation, they misidentify somebody, tough bro. But if there are private outlets like news media who reported, hey, this is the guy when it's not the guy, then you have a false statement. Now, is it you got to make sure that even within the context and that it is truly false. And then on top of that, you got to prove the harm. So it sucks to have people be not liking you. But I think in that context of the Guthrie case, the false suspect could show, hey, I got all these emails. I got all these DMs. I got all these threats. I got all these people hate me now. That's reputational damage. Did it stop him from being considered in certain employment contexts or something? There are ways you can go about it, but certainly not an easy road.
Right. Any, I mean, what would, because I know that's the hardest part. I know someone has actually been sued and sued for defamation before, and actually showing the monetary aspect, is that what they have to do in a defamation suit, just actually show the monetary impact of this? Or is it a lower bar that has to be hurdled?
You've got to prove damages, and that usually includes economic harm. And so how has this economically harmed you? You know, somebody not liking you, that sucks. But what sort of money does that translate into if you get a DM from a complete stranger who says, you know, you're a shitbag murderer or something? That sucks. But is that like $100? Is that like $1,000? How do we how do we calculate that? The damages can get dicey.
Right.
Yeah. It's... some sort of rails need to be put up soon, I would think, because at some point something's going to happen with these platforms, I would imagine, that's going to take them to the cleaners in one way, shape, or form, where they're going. And that's probably what it's going to have to take. I don't know. I mean, they can get ahead of this, but they seem to be waiting, and I don't know why. Because probably whatever the settlement's going to be someday, they're making far more letting the fire spread, because people like watching the fire. Yeah. Unfortunately, that I think is the reality of it. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or Substack. The link is in the description. We'll continue this part of the conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Sheriff Nanos went on the Today Show this week and told America investigators are definitely closer. He said he personally believes Nancy is alive. The FBI has moved its command center from Tucson to Phoenix. The task force has scaled down from a mass resource operation to a dedicated homicide and FBI team. Jen Coffendaffer, who knows what FBI investigations look like from the inside, told Newsweek this week that this case is the polar opposite of cold. And what do you know? Jennifer Coffendaffer is joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. We got two FBI special agents retired with us today to break this down from both different worlds of the FBI. Jen, I want to start with what you're talking about here. Were you saying it's the opposite of a cold case here? This thing is red hot, I believe, is what you said. Give me some insight here, because, I mean, to a lot of us on the outside looking at this, we're going, Is it red hot? I mean, what? Tell me what you mean. What's going on here?
This is what I mean. I think it's important to first understand the definition of a cold case. A cold case is leads that have absolutely no end. They've already been run to ground. There's nothing new coming in. There is nothing for investigators to do anymore because everything we knew about is done. So it's a rotten, dead, cold, yucky end. It's put on a shelf until another unit could come along and maybe take a look at it as a cold case. So it's just stacking up there, gaining dust with the rest of cases that are considered cold. This is the opposite of this. Investigators are drinking from a fire hose. There's 30,000 leads that they're still trying to sift through. There's all that footage of the vehicles, which I think is one of the number one things they need to be looking at. And that's not going to be investigators. That's going to be analysts behind the scenes. In other words, that 2:28 time mark, you know, moving probably 15, 20 minutes outside of that. I want to see all that video footage from Circle K's, businesses, residences, street cams, all of that. They've got the DNA they're still trying to make sense of. They have now, it was so funny. I just mentioned they also need to re-canvas. And then they went out and re-canvassed because it just seems to me they didn't do how you do a canvas right. And how you do a canvas right is you meet with fellow investigators, you write up a list of literally about 30 questions, exhaustive questions, and everyone asks the same questions. And you spend an inordinate amount of time in with those individuals to get answers. I don't think that was done. I think they're redoing it. And then, of course, now we know they're asking about, did you have any Wi-Fi signal issues? Well, that should have been asked day one, because the possibility of them using jammers in a case like this is possible, although I didn't think, I still don't think they did. And if they did, they were lousy ones.
Is there a threshold here, a specific type of lead or convergence of information where investigators genuinely feel the walls are closing in on a suspect versus a kind of optimism that comes from just, you know, still having open leads in a situation like this?
Yeah, I think you definitely ask just the right question. There are two different kinds of leads. And one is your more general lead. You got to run these down, but you don't know that it's going to lead anywhere. The other one is one that you think you might already know the solution. I actually heard the best analogy from Greg McCrary. I'm going to tell you what it is. It's the difference between having a puzzle. When you get the puzzle in the box, you know you have all the pieces and you look on the front and that tells you the end. These guys are working on a puzzle that they don't have the picture to draw from. They've got all these pieces and they keep trying and trying and pushing, and then they throw that one out because it doesn't match. So to your point, where are we at? Are they more just trying and, you know, it's trial and error and they don't really have the picture on the front of the box? I'm going to say I think they have a partial picture.
Yeah, and Jen, so out of these 30,000 leads that are coming in, you know, it's voluminous, and yeah, it's red hot because I think it's like in a forge in a fire. You know, they're getting closer to what they really want to focus on because they've got a lot of filters in place. What do you think they're using right now as their main filters to kind of filter out the chaff? I know we got to cover every single lead, but what do you think they're using as their main focus of energy for those filters?
I love this question. So first of all, I think number one, to triage, you have to remove all those leads that are really hypothesis. You wouldn't believe how many calls I've gotten just last week. Unfortunately, people have found my number and they found my email, and they're inundating me. I feel like a mini version of what the FBI is going through. It's unbelievable, but there's a big difference between hypothesis and facts. So to me, what they're getting rid of is they just need to go down to who has specific information like this. I think I recognize porch guy, and I think he could be X. And I think that because of blah, 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 and let them run that down. That's an important lead. Or a neighbor says, I think I saw a blue car 2 weeks ago that doesn't belong in the neighborhood, or how about that white van, whatever it might be. Those are the ones they're getting to, people that actually have direct knowledge of that neighborhood and of that porch guy.
On the vehicle thing, because the vehicle thing has been really something that I've been pondering for a long time. I mean, it's the middle of the night. There's not a lot of traffic going on out there to begin with. So to me, I would think, okay, there are cameras all over the place. To see a handful of vehicles in the general vicinity, this vehicle had to have shown up on people's cameras. We just have to identify which one it is. Why is it that, are they having difficulty doing this? Or is it one of these situations where, yeah, there's a lot of camera identification out there where you can kind of tell a make of a vehicle, but maybe not down to the plate level where it's getting hard to identify exactly who owns X vehicle? What's going on there? Because that seems to me like it could be a gold mine of information. And it's not like 5 o'clock on a Friday where you're trying to decipher the traffic pattern. There's nobody out at that time. It's pretty dead. Why is it seemingly so difficult right now to really hone in on a vehicle of interest in this case?
I think the biggest problem has been this light pollution ordinance. I don't know how far that ordinance spread. I've shared with you before. Yeah. Westlake, Texas, take a look at it. That's where I lived, and absolute pitch black. Mm-hmm. Not allowed floodlights. You're not allowed any light. So even if a Ring camera or a Nest picks it up, unless they have some ambient source of light. And by the way, we do know this was a full moon. So yeah. I agree with you, Tony. There is enough, because even in these areas, it's like a flashlight that comes down, the moon does. So I agree with you. What is the problem? I think it's a problem with making out plates and running those vehicles down, even making out the vehicle to get down to make and model. We know that, I mean, at Quantico in Virginia, there's literally a unit that does that. That's all they do. They know everything about cars. Oh, actually, we saw that in the Brian Koberger case, right? That special agent came forward about the vehicle. He was ended up not being broad enough and then later had to go back and make it a little broader. But nevertheless, that's what they do. And apparently they still can't get anything.
Yeah. And even in my neighborhood, I mean, a lot of times these houses we know in Nancy's area are that big pieces of property. They're kind of spread out. And I really wonder, you know, how much a ring cam on a doorknob is or on a door is going to pick up movement on the street if it's not programmed to do that. Because I turn mine down so it doesn't actually go on the street, so I don't capture every car going back and forth. So I also wonder that. I'm curious also, you know, whether we're talking about cars or I was really hopeful on Walmart coming through with something too, which we haven't really heard about. Do you think they're hitting any dead ends right now in any of the leads or any of the possibilities that we've earlier thought about and are not really panning out?
Yeah, great question, because the Walmart bag exclusively made at Walmart and exclusively sold at Walmart, except for possible resale possibilities. That bag, Nanos on the second told NBC, listen, we're looking at third-party vendors possibly. Well, if it's a Goodwill, I could buy that, you know, a thrift shop. I'm not buying that eBay, Pinterest, Mercari. For those of you, and you guys probably don't shop on there, but those are places that you look for Lululemon and Athleta and expensive brand names where you could get something that's $300 for $100. And the people selling those, they need to make money. So they're not going to be selling some $10 Walmart used bag.
Yeah.
They don't make any money. So he mentioned online sales. I'm just not buying that you could buy anything like that online. The idea of a third party maybe being a thrift store, I could see that. So it seems like Walmart is not coming through, Drake. That's what I determined from that.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's one of those things that Nanos has said that makes me go, is he just randomly saying things out loud that are coming to his head? I mean, I think we've all ran it through our mind of like, well, could they have possibly bought this somewhere other than Walmart, like a thrift store? Maybe, sure. I mean, the odds are more likely Walmart. It looks like it's a $10 bag to begin with. So not that high of a ticket item, not something that's typically going to be resold. Usually if that's used, it's gone, it's done. So is that a possibility? Sure. I mean, Nanos has said so many damn things in the course of this case to people that have interviewed him. And it seems that a lot of people will take what he says and then put a lot of weight on those words. Is this one of those moments where we're putting too much weight on his words and his words really don't have anything to back up what's coming out? It's just, well, maybe it's another place. Maybe it was a thrift store. Maybe it was there's really nothing backing it other than maybe Walmart hasn't come through yet saying, yeah, here's a guy with the receipts.
Yeah, you know, that has been a big problem. But nevertheless, I look at it this way, Tony. Who knows the most about this case that is talking?
Yeah. Now,
there's no one else. Anybody else talking, any talking heads that are talking are using their experience plus what is known to make some extrapolations and some hypotheses. But then the photographic evidence, we can look and see a lot of different things in these photos. So that's actually good. But other than that, Nanos knows more than anyone that's talking. And so I think we have to at least listen.
Or does he? I mean, maybe he's just as clueless as everybody else. I mean, that's kind of what it feels like. I mean, he has to have some more knowledge, but does that knowledge actually equate into information that's going to be valuable in finding Nancy? Or is it just, you know, the plethora of information that's coming in from so many different directions? Since we're talking about vehicles, something that keeps getting brought up and thrown out into the ether, so I thought, well, let's address this. Annie Guthrie's vehicle returned to her family this week after being held as evidence. Let's talk about that for a moment. In your experience, when investigators return retained property to people close to the victim, what does that decision signal about where those individuals stand in an investigation? And obviously, yes, they have already been cleared by Nanos.
Right. You know, he says they were cleared. He said that a long time ago. He intimated that even before he gave out the written statement.
Yep.
Why did he even do that? I think it was because in the Hyde, Idaho 4 case, you had people being terrorized.
Yeah.
Terrorized online. You have threats coming in. You know, you're trying to keep these people safe as they're going through the worst hardship of their lives. And I think that's why he came out. I don't think it was an emotional come out. Some people say, oh, he was being emotional. Well, I have to say it wasn't written like an FBI agent would write it. But nevertheless, them following up with letting the car loose, which I'd called them, and they were great. You know, they let me go right through to the PIO office. I was able to talk to them, and they said, we're releasing it. That was a couple of days ago. And so, you know, because they should, they need to.
You know, and the interesting thing with the car is people kept bringing it up and kept saying, you know, the son-in-law, the son-in-law, the son-in-law, which fits no pattern of son-in-law's behavior whatsoever from the very get-go. And granted, you got to eliminate these people in the inner circle first, because you know, when you're looking at the research and the probabilities, that's where it starts. And then you eliminate and keep moving on. But the interesting thing about the car that people weren't really considering, they looked at it, they have the car because they're a suspect. Not necessarily. If DNA is still the main thing they're hoping for on this one, especially since we have mixed DNA in the house, where are they going to get a lot of DNA from? Her car. So you maintain the possession of that car to get all the DNA you possibly can so that there's anyone associated with anyone related to the family that you can eliminate them from the DNA in the house. And so for me, it wasn't holding onto the car because they're suspecting someone in the family. They're holding onto the car so they can get as much DNA out of that car so they can eliminate other DNA found in that house as being related in some way. They're looking for things that are standing out from that arc. And I think because Nancy spent so much time with the daughter and with the son-in-law, they had to make sure they eliminated DNA from the possible suspects and, you know, make that other filter they need. Just a thought. What do you think about it?
No, Robin, I love that. And then I'm going to pony on to that also, is we don't know, and investigators have to figure out whether she was followed from Annie's house and or whether they were laying in wait for her. And there's tracking devices, GPS, slap-ons, and things that can be done. You know, I did it to my son. You know, work not only in the bureau, right? The trackers, but it's easy. Whoop, it's there.
Yeah, and there's a lot. Yeah,
and that person could have touched the car. I mean, there was. That's what I thought was taking so long is evaluating prints and any evidence that could have been left by somebody who would have been there stalking from that point, which is exactly to your point.
Because some people are thinking, you know, when you get in that negative confirmation bias, you think they're holding on to because they're waiting to get the thing that's going to break through to get the son-in-law. No, they held on to it longer because they keep getting data from it. And or they're waiting for another return. To your point, I'm heading on the DNA side. But yeah, great observations on the tracking potentially that they could extrapolate from the car's systems as well. And that might have taken some time. So they have to hold on to it and they might have to do follow on. So to me, it was just a data trove, not because of who they're targeting, but because of who they need to eliminate. So they could actually identify what things stood out. Where did it go? Who was tracking it? So yeah, great points.
And real quick, Robin, if I can, Tony, sorry.
Yeah.
Can I pick back that? I've got a case right now, and it involves heavy extraction of vehicle information from those from the vehicle. And that takes forever. Yeah. You would all the processes to get the raw raw information and break it down and then to evaluate what you have, because it tells everything, obviously, from stop, start, braking, amount of acceleration, blah, 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 blah. And that would have taken a long time to get that. And to me, they were looking for a pattern. Was it every Sunday night he said he took
this? Yes, 100%.
And, oh, we've got a pattern in place. You know, that's what they were looking for. Everybody wanted them so convicted. And it's amazing and wonderful that the Bureau said, listen, let's just make sure we make sure that they weren't involved. And that's what they did.
Yeah, and also, I'm sorry, Jen and I are going back and forth, you know, as well as, you know, because I looked it up, you know, Nanus's department has a clearance rate of 100%, 12 for 12. It's not a huge amount of homicides in the last year, but it's still a really good rate. So his detectives are very, very skilled at what they do. The other thing, too, just like when at the very onset, I took a look at the pacemaker. And when I did the research on the pacemaker and whether you could get pings on it, everything I found came up said, no, it doesn't work that way and blah, blah, blah. But lo and behold, they finally did it. So I also think that it took some time potentially because this department might not have faced this kind of extrapolation of data from vehicles before. So it might have taken some time to figure out and innovate how to do that, who to get the right contacts and all that. And so sometimes when you're doing a new or utilizing a new skill set, tool or technique, or even have to develop one on the fly, it takes a little bit more time to do that. So I think a little more grace of time is important when you're looking at the ground truth and not something you saw on Criminal Minds.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the reality is it takes more time and to have grace with the folks who are trying to utilize the technology to their benefit in the investigation. But while the clock is ticking, I think, and that's the sad, scary part is no matter what you're doing, no matter how well-intentioned, that clock is ticking. And every second that is spent at going down one road or one lane needs to get somewhere because you don't want to have spent 4 or 5 days or whatever time on something that's not going to get you to where you need to go. So all of those decisions, all of those paths that people are going to go down, that the investigators are going to go down, better be some of the best options to be traveling. Your thoughts in the comments section on our YouTube or our Substack. We'll continue that conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Spring is sprung and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big.